Across the Americas on Pan Am Saturn Galaxy, throughout Europe on the Astra satellite system, and around the world on shortwave and internet. This is the Dutch International Service. Media Network, the weekly communications magazine with Jonathan Marks and Diana Janssen.
Hello, welcome to the programme from Diana Janssen and myself. There's been a marked increase in the number of reactions we're getting via internet at the moment, partly because of the worldwide web pages we opened in April. Also, a rise in the number of useful letters to the show, and wherever possible we try to work these into the programme format. Our fax number, incidentally, is open 24 hours a day. The number is 31 35 6724 239. Just added a 6 to that number. It's 31 35 6724 239. And our email address is letters@rnw.nl. Items in brief. And in Geneva, it seems that the Red Cross Broadcasting Service is in the process of a major reorganisation of its programming. During this period, which should last until September, the RCBS monthly programmes in 5 languages via Swiss Radio International have been suspended. The ICRC plans to launch a new service from September onwards with shorter broadcasts than before, but then on a weekly basis. John Kelly sends us a note on the internet as a result of last week's show, asking if we still have plans for a medium wave loop. Indeed we do, although for the moment we can't supply the publication Long Distance Medium Wave Listening in an electronic form, only in the snail mail. It is free though. You can send us a fax on the number I just gave if you want one in a hurry. David Norrie in Paulshof, South Africa, sent us some interesting comments regarding shortwave receivers. He feels that Low Electronics in the UK have missed the boat because their receivers don't have so-called passband tuning. Any real DX machine should have it, says David. Well, I tend to agree that the facility is extremely useful when you're trying to separate a weak station from the background noise. But then all these features cost extra money. But we'll pick up your suggestion to see what people think about the top facilities they use the most. I suppose the EDXE conference in Denmark this coming weekend will be the first opportunity to do some research into the matter. Well, thanks for your time, David, and trouble, of course, in writing to us. Talking of Scandinavia, Roy Sundgren, legendary in radio circles as the guy behind Radio Scandinavia, has written to us. Roy, remember, has run test transmissions on Radio Andorra and Radio Polonia in the past, but the tests have never been translated into commercial radio for Scandinavia, which is clearly Roy's dream. He notes that Sweden has now released some of its medium wave frequencies to the highest bidder, 1485, 1584 and 1602 kilohertz are being advertised, it seems, with a maximum power of 1 kilowatt. Maybe that's worth watching. Now let's launch into that promised feature about internet, as seen from the shortwave listener's viewpoint. In the last 6 months, several shortwave listening organisations have discovered that the internet is simply a way to connect up electronic bulletin boards around the world. If 5 years ago you were limited to discussions with people from your own region because others couldn't afford the long-distance telephone charges, well, internet provides a solution. It means it costs you the same to exchange mail with people just down the road as from someone in Australia or Austria or wherever. And as the pathways to your house are able to carry more and more information, so you'll be able to get audio and video in direct competition to existing radio and television stations. No wonder the word internet can strike fear into some people, and yet it's a challenge to others.
Towards 2000 with Media Network here on Radio Netherlands.
Jim Cutler has been following the situation in the United States and joins us on a digital line from his home studio in Boston, Massachusetts. Jim, let's be honest, among the predictions about internet, there's an enormous amount of hype, isn't there?
It is a lot of hype, but you got to be on it right now because things are going to explode. Smart companies like Radio Netherlands are getting worldwide web pages right now. Yeah, maybe you get only 200 people logged in at one time, but that's because it's just in its infancy. I mean, it's going to explode, and if you're real good at it right now, you're going to attract a reputation. More people are going to be logging in. And as there are easier ways to connect to the internet, more and more people are going to get involved, and more people are going to be looking at your page.
But speed remains a problem. The price of 14400 baud modems has dropped considerably in the last few months. Whilst text can be downloaded so fast that it scrolls like a waterfall over the screen, the high-color graphics, which have become the trademark of the World Wide Web, can take forever to build up. It's like watching early slow-scan television pictures from the moon. Faster modems and larger information pipelines are needed to make internet accessible for the average member of the public in Europe, Asia, and North America.
Yeah, that's right. I'm really surprised by that, as a matter of fact, that 28.8 is kind of the standard right now. However, that's all going to change real soon. In the States, there's the ISDN technology that actually Europe has had for a while that's going to explode like wildfire over the next 2 years. The baby bells, the phone systems, the phone companies have a mandate to try and get ISDN into as many homes as possible real quickly. What that's going to do is that'll allow you to download graphics and text and everything else at 5 times the rate that you currently can do it. This allows video conferencing. The reason why the phone companies want to get this into every single home in the United States as quickly as possible is they want to set up the system to be able to sell you movies, to be able to download movies right into your home through the phone system. And there's a lot of other services as well. It's just increasing the size of the pipeline to be able to get more data down to your home and back and forth. It's a two-way system. So much has happened in the past couple of weeks in the United States. It's unbelievable as far as ISDN technology is concerned. Throughout the papers, there have been front page stories on the communication sections saying that the FCC wants to put the brakes on ISDN by charging a lot more money, 22 times the amount that they currently charge for ISDN phone lines. I can call up right now in Boston and get an ISDN line put in for about $50, and then my charge is about $20 a month. Dirt cheap. That's the way it should be in the United States, because that'll encourage more and more people to get it. What the FCC is saying is, wait a minute, some companies are installing ISDN and then using it for about 22 analog lines. In other words, an ISDN line can pass through about 22 analog lines worth of information. So their reasoning is that you should charge 22 times the amount for ISDN. Well, what that's going to do is make it prohibitively expensive, and people aren't going to jump on this technology. And they need to. They need to get ISDN in so they can start accessing things like video on demand and getting Radio Netherlands down their telephone lines, things like that. That was a ruling 2 years ago that the FCC made, saying that you got to charge 22 times the amount. The local phone companies in the United States said, wait a minute, you should reconsider, FCC. We're going to sell ISDN in the meantime for this low price. 2 years have gone by. Now the FCC is saying, we're sticking by our original ruling. We want you to charge 22 times the amount. I mean, this is crazy. In the meantime, 500,000 people in the States now have ISDN lines relatively cheaply into their homes. Pacific Bell in California has this huge program that's exploding now where they want to get ISDN into every home in California, or have it available to every home in California within the next few months, which is very doable because they're way ahead. Now they're very afraid that after spending all this money to upgrade all the systems and the local phone switching networks, that people aren't going to do it.
In the meantime, others are trying to get audio on demand up and running. Hit Radio Holland FM is the latest station claiming a world premiere by offering audio via the internet. The news bulletins broadcast by the station on 1224 and 828 kHz medium wave here in the Netherlands are being stored digitally on a computer server in Hilversum and are made available as a sound file on the internet. The so-called URL address is as follows: http://www.veronica.nl/veronica/hitradio/. But the first on the internet dial was undoubtedly the college radio station of the University of North Carolina, call sign WXYC. If you have the right software, you can still tune into the station live on the internet.
Now the ordinary fellow gets off on a Saturday night, and he gets a chance to see his pal, which ain't no more than right.
Not exactly hi-fi, but then that's not the point. If you want to send an internet reception report to them, the address is Route 1, P.O. Box 284, Pittsburgh, and that's spelled P-I-T-T-S-B-O-R-O, North Carolina 27312 in the USA. That was WXYC, Route 1, P.O. Box 284, Pittsburgh, North Carolina 27312 in the USA. David McConville is the guy who set up the internet connection for WXYC. I asked him how he described the audio quality.
It sounds phenomenally like an AM transistor radio, actually, which is kind of ironic in that, you know, early radio experimenters probably had about the same audio quality that we have with WXYC right now. It's all 8-bit. We're transmitting at 32 kilobit packets. You can actually transmit smaller packets, like 16 kilobit, but we're transmitting at 32 because users on Macintoshes and Unix machines can access the signal. If we transmitted at just 16, the audio signal wouldn't break up as much, but we would kind of cut out the ability of Unix workstations to receive the signal.
So obviously you need the right software to be able to hear the signal, and presumably
right.
You need a fast enough connection. I mean, if you're sitting at home with an ordinary modem, I suppose it's tough luck, is it?
You can receive kind of a choppy signal over a 14.4 modem. I've heard back from people like in Australia and London that are running on a flip connection over a 14.4 modem, and they are getting a signal, and they can actually tell what the songs are sometimes. You know, as the bandwidth available on the net increases and as modem speeds increase, of course, that's going to become, the audio signal will become higher and higher quality, and the packet breakup will be less and less.
What sort of response have you had? Because how long have you been running?
We announced it the beginning of November, and basically I've heard from all over the world. It's been pretty phenomenal. At first there were a lot of concerns about what kind of bandwidth we were going to take up on the net, like if we would flood the net with these packets and you know, it'd bring the whole thing to its knees or something. But the way the reflector software works is that it only sends out audio packets to people that receive it. So we're not multicasting or broadcasting in the traditional sense. We're only sending out packets when a request is sent. So it keeps the load to a minimum. I've heard back from Australia, Poland, Sweden, Japan, all over the U.S., a lot of people saying they can get it pretty well. Some people saying they're having the signal's really choppy. Like, they liken it to driving out of the signal range of an off-air station when the signal starts to break up. And it's just because packets are being sent and the computer can't receive the packets fast enough, so you get breaks in the signal.
This really is a sort of radio on demand, as it were, because, as you point out, I mean, you're not squirting this audio into the internet all the time. It's only when people ask for it.
But since this is in real time, it raises some interesting legal questions, since most of the laws that are forming now around net audio are based on the assumption that the audio files are downloaded and then listened to from a hard drive and duplicated in that way. But since this is in real time, it kind of opens up a whole other field of what the possibilities are.
Do you regard it then as broadcasting or narrowcasting or what?
We tend to call it narrowcasting or unicasting because, like you said, since it's audio on demand, only the people that want to receive it will receive it.
Presumably you must have an idea about when you're on the air, who's actually asking for it. I mean, would you say you're on the air all the time or intermittently or what?
Oh, there's usually somebody always connected. I mean, we originally did it just so the basement that we're in or our computing facilities are, we can't receive the radio station very well. So we kind of wanted to do it just so we could have radio on the PCs that we work on, and that worked pretty well. And so now mostly somebody from our office is always connected, and we have logs of people that connect, and there's usually somebody almost always connected to it. But since they're only 32 kilobit packets, they're fairly small, and so it doesn't really put much of a drain on the network at all.
There are all types on the Internet. Christopher Yavlov is regarded as a communication specialist here in the Netherlands, and claims to have posted the first opera on the electronic highway.
One opera that I wrote for the Boston Lyric Opera in Massachusetts, was, I think, the first computer-assisted opera in which every aspect of the development and composition was done by computer. And when I discovered the World Wide Web, I thought this would be a great place for promoting this opera or letting people hear it. So on my homepage on the World Wide Web, I was able to divide the opera into 16 chunks and sample it in down at as high quality as possible so that it wouldn't take people that long to download each portion, and provide a space where anybody from anywhere in the world can go there, read the libretto, listen to that page, turn the page, read the libretto, listen to that page, or listen to it while they're reading. There's been quite a bit of positive feedback from that.
As a public service organization, it costs money for Radio Netherlands to participate on the internet with the colorful pages that make up the World Wide Web. Other media organizations in the Netherlands, though, are making money from the internet experience by renting out their space on the electronic highway to organizations who want publicity in the form of pages with a commercial message. The market for this is wide open at the moment, with companies charging a few dollars or thousands of dollars a month to ensure that a page is available to a potential readership, and I stress potential, of 30 million and growing. But people have to find your pages in the maze of material available, and organizations such as universities, who form much of the backbone of the communications infrastructure, are concerned that people with commercial goals are joining the system. Even though the software to get onto the internet is still often difficult to set up initially, few predicted the enormous growth we've seen in the last 12 months. Paul Dinnerson is the cash trial coordinator at DigiCash in Amsterdam. He feels that the internet explosion hasn't really happened yet. It will come when people can order goods through their computers and pay for them safely.
Until now, what you had to do in order to order products on the internet is send your credit card number over the internet. The thing is that when you send your information, including your credit card number over the internet, anybody can pick up that number. You have to be a hacker in order to do that, but there is always a way to get this information from anyone around the world, because the information is not scrambled or coded or whatever. It is open information. Anybody can read it. With eCash, they are using an algorithm with encoding that nobody can read it, and even supercomputers cannot decode the information you send.
But the beauty of internet is that you can dial into the glorified electronic bulletin board and click between pages in Asia and Europe without a second thought. You only pay a local telephone call and a subscription fee. And it's the same if you pick up information from the other side of the world or just round the corner. But will that change when the commercial communications companies really get a foothold?
There will always be a free exchange of information. I can always send you email. I can always get information from people who put their information on the internet just because they think it's important to give their information to the people, because it's free. So there will be two mainstreams on the internet. One is commercial, one is free.
But Christopher Yavaloff believes that the commercial side of the operation could be the downfall of the whole idea.
I'm sure the commercial aspect of everything always has a future, and I'm sure in the end we'll see shops and also, like we have a few now, but we'll see shopping malls on the internet probably. But whether people will use them is another story. I mean, home shopping networks in the United States were very popular, but many of the things that are being offered for sale currently in internet shops are not real tangible objects. They're software elements or downloadable virtual things like graphics files and words of wisdom or programs and this sort of thing. I think that commercialization of the net will certainly make it a very different place, and possibly might even, if it gets out of hand, it might make it a much worse place.
But the clue is in the modems and digital telephone lines. Jim Cutler again.
28.8 is what your modem can do and what my modem can do. With ISDN, you get the equivalency of about 119. I mean, it's huge. It's a huge increase. And it's also kind of, it's not quite exponential, but it's a huge increase over 2088. Pacific Bell, who is really trying to push ISDN in California, has just entered into agreements with Microsoft and other companies to support ISDN and to start making hardware available for ISDN. Right now, I can pick up an ISDN modem for about $1,000. They say that by the end of the year, there'll be so many ISDN modems on the market, supply and demand, that it'll be about $300, which is very reasonable.
But phone companies are worried about another development, namely the internet phone. If you can squirt text and radio programs into the electronic highway, why not a live phone call?
If you have a direct connection to the internet, not through a provider like CompuServe or America Online, but a direct connection to the internet, and it's very common in the United States to get it, it's very simple, you can do it in Holland. You can download some free software from Israel, from a company in Israel, that allows you to make telephone calls on the internet. And how it works like this. Once you download the free software, you run it, and you'll get a listing of hundreds of people who currently have the software who are logged into the internet right now. You can choose any one of those people, highlight the person you want on your screen, hit your space bar, and their sound card will ring like a telephone. It'll, it'll produce a bell. And across the bottom of their screen, it'll say, Jonathan Marks is trying to initiate a telephone call with you from Holland. And if you want, you can pick up the call, you talk into a microphone to your sound card, and you and this other person can have a real-time conversation back and forth. And it's free for the moment. I have no idea what it's going to do to the phone companies, how they're going to react. In ham radio, the phone companies go nuts when ham radio operators make phone patches. They hook up their ham radio equipment to the telephone network to allow people to make transatlantic calls. It's only allowed in certain countries. Many countries, like the European countries, you can't make transatlantic calls like that. Phone companies are very upset about that, that they don't want you to make calls. So I don't know what this is going to do. But this is so typical. The internet is coming along so fast. Technology is exploding so fast. You can throw copyright laws out the window. They all need to be rewritten. Transatlantic telephone call protection has to be thrown out the window and rewritten. And you ain't seen nothing yet, because the technology is going to keep on getting faster and faster and faster. Every new idea that comes along, someone is sitting at home with their computer thinking about how they can turn that into a business.
That was Jim Cutler, and I hope that the information was of interest, especially to people who can't access the internet for whatever reason. Part of the purpose of this show is to examine the communication systems of tomorrow. And we fully realize that in some parts of the world, what we think of as slow is regarded as lightning speed in other places. Rest assured, though, that no matter how you contact us here at Radio Netherlands, we value your response. We also have a free pamphlet which talks about more of the connection between radio and computers. If you'd like a copy, drop us a line and ask for Info Dutch, Edition 4. Time to bring up the line to Moscow to answer a question from Bill Harris of Darwin, Australia, who recalls we had fairly regular contact in the past with Vasily Strelnikov in Moscow, but things have gone quiet. Vasily used to work at the English section of Radio Moscow, then went to the USA for a while to work as a disc jockey, and then returned to the Russian capital to be the program director of a US-backed music station called Radio 7. Have a listen.
Good evening, everyone. This is Raymond Ritchie, General Manager of Radio 7. It is with a feeling of great honor that I announce tonight Radio 7's all-new format. Starting with this program, all your favorites will be played on Radio 7. All your favorite techno, rap, heavy metal, pop, trash. Just like all the other radio stations in Moscow.
Vasily Strelnikov.
Don't say we didn't warn you.
Last time we spoke to Vasily, he mentioned that new stations on the FM dial were migrating from the old Russian FM band, starting at 66 megahertz, to the more traditional FM band of 87.6 to 108 megahertz used in other parts of the world. The competition between the broadcasters is quite fierce in Moscow. You've got stations like Radio Rossi Nostalgie, Open Radio, Radio 101, Radio Maximum, as well as Vasily's own Radio 7. So what's happening?
Well, radio is certainly still in its infancy here. And at the same time, this little baby is beginning to grow, because last time we talked, there was, what, about three or four maybe stations on the, as you referred to it, the new FM band, the 88 to 108 frequency range. And most of the broadcasting was done on the old band, on the UKV. But now, the new FM band, the Western FM band, is full of radio stations. New stations going up all the time. You can tell that people are suddenly beginning to realize that there are things called programming formats. There is one station test transmitting right now on the FM band, which is playing only Russian hit music, whereas formerly you'd get a mix of everything, French, Italian, rock, metal. It's there. I mean, it's growing. And at the same time, there are stations going off the air, mainly for financial reasons. One station in particular, called Radio Prestige, did a mix of Russian and English and new wave sort of jazz. Another radio station on the AM band, called a radio station called Radio Vox, their president was murdered just weeks ago, I guess. Apparently, there were millions and millions and millions of rubles in unpaid bills. I really don't know whether it's the local FCC's way of saying pay up, but things are happening.
Does it also mean to say there's less English and more Russian on the airwaves?
There is really no English on the radio bands here, radio waves here, apart from the BBC relay on 1260, 1 hour of VOA Europe late at night on open radio, and the 8 hours of English on Radio 7.
So why does your radio station put out English?
Well, we do 4 hours in English, basically a morning show. Music, entertainment, information, news, weather, sports. The typical morning show you'd hear anywhere around the world, I guess. And also 4 hours in English in the evening from 6 to 10 p.m., a program that is that I have the honor of hosting, a program called Vasily's Neighborhood. The main target is the expat community here in Moscow.
Can't you put up a satellite dish and watch programs?
Oh, you can do that, sure. You can do that, but the choice of channels would be rather limited. Moscow is rather far away from any of the real good birds, I guess. CNN is around. CNN is available on the UHF band here. There's also a cable system here, which is doing pretty well, called Cosmos TV. But, I mean, you have to subscribe to that and pay money, and all that is very expensive, and not everybody would really want to pay for that service.
We've seen that with the recent murder of the head of Ostankyo Television, I mean, reports that the Russian media may be clamping down again. Is that actually visible at all or not?
Let's put it this way. It has in no way affected what I say on the air, what our radio station is doing.
What about the East European FM band, though? Can you find radios in Moscow with 66 to 72 megahertz on them?
In fact, a few years ago, somebody predicted the eventual death of the UKV band. I can't really say that it's going to die out pretty soon, but if you look at what's available in the stores, you will definitely see that you can easily buy a radio with the Western FM band, and it'll take about half a day to find a Russian-made radio with the UKV band. Although I must say that people like Sony or Grundig, Philips, are coming out with radio sets, with boom boxes and stereo sets that do cover both FM bands. I would rather say that it's just a little bit more stagnant. The development of UKV has really slowed down, whereas the FM is rapidly expanding.
And can you hear Radio Netherlands 1386 relay out of Kaliningrad?
I can. I have a big antenna.
Haven't we all? Vasily Strelnikov there. One final jingle, which is a clue to a Media Network roadshow later this month.
RTL, de journal, mam, j'en vends pas. Guten Morgen.
Yes, Luxembourgish. Why did Radio Luxembourg disappear from the 49 and 19 meter shortwave band, and will they ever return? And what's left of the great 208? We're off to explore.
And now over to Melbourne, where Mike Bird is waiting with the propagation review. Mike, what's it been like over the last 7 days?
Diana, solar activity was again very low and no solar flares were reported. The solar flux was 67 at the beginning of the week, and by Tuesday it had moved up to 68. The average works out to 66.8, which equals an effective sunspot number of 0, and that is down 22 points on the previous week's level. The geomagnetic field disturbance indicator, the estimated planetary A index, range between 6 and 35, which represents quiet to minor storm conditions. The magnetic field was stormy on Wednesday the 24th. From Thursday through to Monday, it ranged between quiet to unsettled. But on Tuesday, it became stormy again due to a coronal hole.
And what about between now and next Thursday, June the 8th?
IPS Radio and Space Services expect solar activity will remain low. The geomagnetic field should remain active to minor storm today. From tomorrow until Monday, the magnetic field should be generally active. And then from Tuesday, we should enjoy quiet to unsettled conditions for the remainder of the week.
Thanks, Mike. And that's all we have time for in this edition of the program. Jonathan and I wish you a pleasant weekend.
Call the answer line, write us a letter, or simply fax your facts to country code 31, then 35724239.